Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. This hour, the holidays are supposed to be a happy time, but not everyone feels that way. For those with mental health challenges, holiday stress can make things worse. We'll talk with experts about ways to support your mental health. Armadillos have made themselves at home in parts of Illinois. We'll talk about how they got here and the challenges they bring. We'll also hear about farmers using bats to help control pests. We'll check in with some students about new policies that limit cell phone use in schools. Ameren is working to renovate natural gas fields, what the utility says that could mean for consumers. And we'll also visit with the former ambassador and U.S. Senator Carol Mosley Braun about her new memoir. Those stories and more ahead on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. The holidays can be stressful, but for those who suffer from mental health challenges, holiday stress can make their conditions worse. So we check in with some experts about the best ways to support your mental health this season. Patrick Smith speaks with Holly Branshaft-White, who's the Chief Clinical Officer of Shift Behavioral Health and a licensed clinical social worker. Also Matthew Davison, the CEO of the National Alliance on Mental Illness based in Chicago.
So I want to take a moment, you know, sort of set where we're at and just acknowledge that despite what, you know, the way it's depicted in media and the way, you know, all the holiday cheer, this can be a really tough time for people, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I think it can be really difficult, probably for a few different reasons. I mean, I think the world at large is a tough place right now. And I think the holiday season can bring up feelings of grief and loneliness and isolation and overwhelm. So it can definitely be a complicated time for a lot of people.
Matthew, I mean, what do you hear from folks specifically around the holiday season? What are you most helping people with?
Sure. I mean, the holidays in particular can bring up a mix of emotions because, as you point out, the messaging outwardly, the world we're seeing are the same old songs of happy and cheer and kind of you're supposed to feel a certain way. At least you feel that pull. You see the movies, you see the images, but not all of us might be feeling that way at any given time. And that's okay. But what we say typically during a season like this is people are wrestling with all sorts of things. It's a time of overcommitments. Your weekends aren't really those downtimes anymore. You're kind of not giving those routines any more attention that you usually do. So you're making less space for yourself, which is stressful. And then on top of all that, you're not getting enough time just to kind of take care of yourself in these moments because you're kind of overcommitting. And it's important to kind of prioritize what's giving you the downtime that you need with everything that's going on.
I mean, this time of year feels like, besides all the other things, it's a time where you should be showing love to your family members and other loved ones and supporting them, which obviously is important and a great thing to do, but you're saying that that can leave less time or not enough time for yourself.
Sure, absolutely. And then we see it traditionally right around the holidays is, you know, your Saturdays no longer look like Saturdays. The things that you kind of make plans for yourself that typically gives you that sense of centering or that time where you get yourself your peace. Those are the things we see people typically take off their schedule to make room for a holiday party or a family commitment or another thing. And then all of a sudden, your days are quickly stacking up for all these other things and you're not giving yourself that enough time for that bandwidth to have. And all of a sudden, you're kind of in all sorts of different spaces and it's feeling very stressful and it's not feeling kind of the way that you imagined it might feel. And it also oftentimes evokes other feelings of maybe folks that you wish were here still or mm-hmm. or things that you know you were still doing with a loved one or a family member, that relationship is no longer there. So the holiday messaging itself can sometimes underscore the gaps in our lives or yeah. the things we want to kind of think about or pay attention to in that way.
Can I ask you two, as professionals on this, as experts, do you talk to each other or to the other people you work with like before this holiday season comes up? Like, it's coming again. Like, I don't know, are you almost bracing yourself for this time of year?
Yeah, I mean, I think that what I see in my circles is I really try to just normalize talking about this stuff all the time. And I think it's especially relevant at this time. But, you know, I am constantly trying to remind myself, the individuals that I work with, friends, family, that nobody is really going to prioritize you except for you. You know, nobody is going to make sure that you're taking time for yourself. You're the best one to be doing that. And so as much as you can keep that on your radar, especially going into this holiday season, I think as Matt is saying, around routines is really important and just making sure to do your best at giving yourself grace, implementing different coping tools throughout the day, throughout the weeks, leading up to the actual holiday days that are going to offer some relief, some support. It's really, really important.
And you know, these are very broad terms, mental illness, mental health. Obviously, for people who don't already have, you know, they're not already struggling with something, this can be a tough time. But it also can exacerbate problems for people who, or issues for people who are already suffering things. I mean, what sort of conditions or what sort of situations are exacerbated the most by the holiday season?
Oh, man. You know, I think what comes up for me most readily is just, as Matt mentioned, thinking about people who are no longer here. You know, I think that loss of stability or anchor in people's lives, the normalcy of tradition, having loved ones around who maybe cannot be with us for any number of reasons, I think feels especially poignant. And just in general, you know, I think when describing mental health or mental illness, that to me sometimes makes it feel so remote, you know, so off in the distance, so removed, when really everybody is managing some unknown or unacknowledged, you know, struggles or low-level anxiety and depression, I think is so normal.
And I know this can also be a tough time for kids and young adults, specifically the mental health of young people. I don't know if either of you have thoughts on how young people specifically are affected during this season.
Yeah, so we see it in a variety of ways. I mean, to be very candid, what we're seeing it right now is a lot of kiddos are stressed out given the past few weeks and months of, you know, getting walked to school by fellow neighbors and things like that, where they're trying to understand the world around them right now. And the gaps that are occurring and worrying about maybe their parents or their neighbors from another country and whether their friend's going to be at the holiday party and things like that. These are very real things happening right now. And parents are calling and wondering, what's the best way to educate my son or daughter about the proper techniques for mental health? And typically what we see coming in from parents is, what's the right way to approach just talking about it?
Yeah.
And how do we talk about it with our teenager, about how to access resources or what's a safe place for them to kind of get care or those entry points for those conversations, which is really important around this time.
So NAMI, obviously the National Alliance on Mental Illness, runs the 988. I should say, anyone dealing in mental health crisis or thoughts of suicide, the number is 988. It's a 24/7 lifeline. You've seen an increase, even before the holiday season, an increase in Chicago area calls. Is that right?
We have. So NAMI Chicago operates one of the largest helplines, too, as well. So that's 833-626-4244. And we also handle a bulk of the 988 intake calls that come in as well. Those handle two kind of separate topics or subject matters. But we have very much seen over the past few weeks and months, our city is stressed out. Like, our collective mental health is strained out. I mean, we talk to people about all sorts of, like, benchmarks in the holiday season. Some people are like, I just need to get to Friday, right? Yeah. There's a lot going on. And it's okay to feel that way. And what we do is we operate a free, confidential helpline throughout Chicagoland. And the calls we get are ranging from moms and dads trying to understand mental health better for a loved one. And it's also people calling on behalf of themselves saying, look, I'm not sure what I need, but I know I need something. Can you connect me to a resource that's nearby, easy to get to with transportation? Do they take my insurance and things like that? And we've seen an uptick in that directly kind of related to all the other things going on in our city that have a direct impact on our mental health, both in the near term and in the long term.
And Matthew, can I ask, I stepped over a little bit. Can you give that the NAMI number specifically one more time?
Sure. The NAMI Chicago helpline itself is 833-626-4244.
So we're talking about challenges, but let's talk about the best ways to cope or the best ways to help yourself and help each other. Holly, I'm wondering, how do you stand as an example for the people in your life as far as supporting them or supporting yourself? Like, if I know you're always an expert and you always know, but like, you know, if I'm just an everyday person, what should I be doing to check on myself and check on the people around me?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I think that there are a couple things that can be done. You know, I try to do a sort of gut check with myself and really sort of tune into how I'm feeling. You know, right now I know I'm feeling really tired. And so listening to that and giving space to listen to that and also taking the step to prioritize what it means to take better care of myself in that context. Just in general, I'm trying to be mindful, you know, if there's something that I'm wanting to do, an activity that would offer me some relief, I'm prioritizing scheduling that before I get wrapped up with other obligations. Mm-hmm. I think that it's really hard to slow down and to do that, but taking a moment to listen and put on your calendar, on your schedule, things that really offer some reprieve, some relief, that make you smile. I try to schedule those joyful things before I get too wrapped up in my day-to-day obligations. Yeah. Probably one big thing.
Matthew, how do you know? How does a person know if what they're dealing with is just holiday stress, kind of normal fatigue, or something more severe?
I think the best way to do that is to keep track of yourself and your insight and your daily routines. And if things are getting missed and if you're feeling a certain way more often than not, or things are kind of stacking up and adding up in that way, it's a good time to kind of pump the brakes a little bit and say, this is happening more often than it should be. I'm feeling this way quite more frequently. And this is due to these things where I'm not taking enough time for myself. And it's important, as Holly pointed out, to take those moments to check in with yourself. I mean, my 2-year-old and I very much broke curfew last night, and we stayed up painting holiday ornaments last night. And it was like the best way to end the day, right? Now, was there paint everywhere? And did she go to bed with like blue cat whiskers on her face? Yes. But it was a great way to kind of end the day and center myself, because we were able to do that together. And did that take 4 hours? Absolutely not. But it was a really good little sliver of time to kind of just check in with myself and my loved one in that way, which was really a nice way to spend the night.
You know, Holly, I've heard you both talking about the importance of routines. Why is that structure so important?
You know, I think it just gives a little bit of like a infrastructure to rely on in the midst of the chaos. For me, it really anchors me in like, okay, today is a really chaotic day, but at least I know I can rely on tomorrow's yoga class to ground me a little bit. Mm-hmm. And I feel like having that thing to look forward to, that you know when you show up, you're going to feel good, you're going to come away from it feeling a little bit lighter, is really important. And then I think also what comes to mind is trying to... you know, I think as far as routines and also managing exposure to tough things, I think it's a hard, fine line to be walking, where you're aware of what's happening in the world, especially on social media and the news, but then also creating a little bit of a buffer or boundary where, you know, we can only absorb so much. So I think that routines and structure also kind of help with that to, again, bring us back to ourselves rather than being sort of overstimulated and absorbed in, I think, a lot of the tough stuff that's happening outside.
Yeah. So I mentioned, Holly, you are the chief clinical officer at SHFT Behavioral Health. How are you helping advising your clients at SHFT?
Yeah. So at SHFT, you know, I think there are a couple of things that we're doing. One of our services in particular is, I think, especially relevant for some of the subject matter that we're talking about. So we offer a chat. It's a 30 or 60 minute conversation with a clinical therapist, all in person, which I think is nice. We're trying to get back to being with people and building that relationship. And one thing that's coming across there is really identifying some concrete coping skills that people can use. I think that talking about mental health issues or stress is definitely the first step. I think the next closest step after that is identifying some real ways to manage in your day-to-day life, so that when you're out in the world, you feel like you have some options in your pocket when you feel yourself getting overwhelmed or tearful or just like overstimulated. So identifying those tools are really going to be most helpful.
Excellent. Man, I've been struggling over SHFT, and I should have been saying SHFT this whole time.
You're
so
great.
Thank you, Holly. Let me ask, we only have about a minute left. We go straight from the stress and anxiety and cheer, but stress and anxiety of the holidays and sometimes more serious issues than that, straight into New Year's and the pressure and the hope in New Year's resolutions. Do you have advice for people on like, should they be going for a new year, new me on January 2nd?
I really struggle with new year, new me. I mean, I think it sounds like a bright, shiny object, but ultimately, you know, I don't think that anybody needs that. I think that it can kind of set us up for feelings of failure or overwhelm or hopelessness if we are, you know, reaching for something that's overwhelming or a big stretch, a change in our day to day. So I would say probably no on the new year, new me. Maybe if there's one or two exciting things that you want to integrate in your day to day life, that is awesome and I think could be really helpful. That's my take.
Excellent. Matt, final word to you. Give people the best mental health advice they can get in 15 seconds.
You're going to take better care of your loved ones and others when you're taking the best care of yourself. So, and it's okay to check in with yourself and take those moments on a daily basis, on a weekly basis, because the people around you that love you are going to be very appreciative for you for doing that.
Wow. That is Matthew Davidson, CEO of National Alliance on Mental Illness Chicago. We've also been with Holly Branshaft-White, Chief Clinical Officer at Shift Behavioral Health. Thank you both again and again. Besides the number that Matthew mentioned, the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline is 988.
Hundreds of students who play brass instruments attended a recent Brass Day at SIU Carbondale. That event was hosted by SIU School of Music to instruct students and learn about music careers. Here's Brian Sapp.
The rooms in Altgeld Hall at SIU get really loud when 20 trumpet players learn how to develop their tone. This session is just part of Brass Day hosted by the SIU School of Music. Middle school and high school students are attending workshops like this one with Ricky Spears. He's the professor of trumpet and assistant director of athletic bands at SIU.
How do I fix it? Oh, I gotta fix the sound on this, and then when I go to the trumpet, man, I already sound better.
In addition to the classes, students attend discussions about careers in music and even listen to a performance by SIU students. Spears says Wednesday's event allows the School of Music to give back to schools in the community.
So this allows us to bring everybody to one place so we can share our expertise and hopefully help our future brass players understand what it is they're doing and how to help benefit them and their band program. Well,
I love playing the trumpet, and it's the career path that I've chosen for like college and beyond.
Nolan Lohman is a senior at Waterloo High School. He's here because he wants to learn more as fast as he can.
I learned the importance of playing without the tuning slide and how much that can impact your sound and affect you and make you a better player.
In addition to the technical skills, Spears hopes students learn that their instrument is fun and they can get better.
You know, they don't have to be a pro to enjoy playing an instrument. Like it should be, it's therapy, it's a hobby, it's whatever they want it to be, but it should be enjoyment and hopefully a path on how to get better.
Lohman's attending with a friend from his high school, and he says he's learned more than technique by coming to Brass Day.
And just being in a room with a bunch of people as passionate as I am about trumpet, it's just a great experience, and it's a really fun thing to do.
I'm Brian Sapp.
Statewide continues in just a moment. Remember, you can find us where you get your podcasts, through the NPR app, and at nprillinois.org. You're listening to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. When you think of armadillos, the state of Texas may come to mind, but as Tanisha Spain reports, the mysterious mammals have found a permanent home in our state.
On farmland near Carbondale, Agustin Jimenez walks past acres of soybeans in a wooded area.
Basically logs that have fallen, and then we look for signs of digging.
Jimenez is a zoology professor at Southern Illinois University. He's hoping to catch images of an elusive animal coming in and out of a burrow.
This camera trap here, and we're going to set up another camera trap on that side to document what is going in and out from both ends of this entrance.
Around 2 in the morning, a 9-banded armadillo shows up, heading out for an overnight meal.
These organisms basically have a compact body. Their nose is very elongated, so their snout is very pointy. And then they have ears that to some people kind of like resemble those of rabbits.
Weighing up to 17 pounds, with short legs, long claws, and a big tail, the armadillo is mostly a nocturnal animal. It spends the night digging for insects to eat. Armadillos are keeping wildlife controllers like David Easton busy. He caught this one-year-old in his yard the morning of our interview on the SIU campus.
It's number 16 that I've caught since the spring on my place alone because they're doing a lot of damage to my grass and my trees.
The creatures are not protected by the Illinois Wildlife Code and can be removed without a permit. Sadly, you're more likely to pass by armadillos as roadkill. That's partly because of poor vision and how they react to noises, like vehicles, when they cross the road.
When they're spooked, they jump straight up. Well, if you straddle them in a car and they come straight up and damage themselves in your undercarriage, they're many times not salvageable anyway.
Beverly Schaffstall is the founder of Free Again Wildlife Rehab in Carterville. She cares for hundreds of injured wild animals. In recent years, she's seen an increase in armadillos, which are a challenge to rehome.
We tried to take them back to an area they came from. They are pretty nomadic. It's not like they've got territory that they defend.
The armadillo's roots are South and Central America. For centuries, they've expanded territory north, and they're the state mammal in Texas. According to the Department of Natural Resources, the animals were first spotted in southern Illinois in 1970. As of 2024, they're found in nearly half the state and as far north as Sangamon County. SIU professor Agustin Jimenez says that part of the reason is our rechanneling of the Mississippi River and its lower water levels, which makes it easier for armadillos to cross into Illinois. Armadillos have little hair and can't survive on ground that is frozen for more than a few days. But climate change means winter in much of Illinois is becoming more bearable.
The warmer winters that then suddenly become shorter and shorter. And then we believe that might have presented these animals with an opportunity to survive.
They're also the only mammals besides humans that carry leprosy, a disease that causes nerve damage. But scientists say it's extremely rare for the animals to pass it on to humans. And the armadillos in Illinois have not been exposed to leprosy.
So the animals that are making it here are those that were like free of infection. So since nobody is infected in probably 300 miles around, then the animals are like in a clean environment.
Still, scientists warn you not to touch the armadillos, which are challenging to document.
That's Tanisha Spain reporting. That reporting made possible by the Backlund Charitable Trust. From one creature to another, if you eat food, you benefit from bats. Bats eat untold tons of pests every night. It helps keep crops healthy and saves farmers money. But on some farms, bats might be able to play an even bigger role. Michael Marks has more on that.
It's a clear September night on a bank above the San Marcos River in central Texas, and a group of folks in headlamps are inspecting a small, noisy creature.
And this is very, very typical of this species. They got a lot to say all the time.
Researcher Melissa Donnelly is holding an evening bat in a cloth bag. It's tiny, no bigger than a clementine. She just caught it over the river in a super-sized tennis net, and now she's measuring it.
Yeah, and so I'm just holding on to the humerus so that I can get to the form.
Donnelly is a science specialist with the nonprofit Merlin Tuttle's Bat Conservation. One of the reasons she's collecting data on this bat is actually to help farmers grow better pecans, farmers like Troy Swift.
So our job is to work with Mother Nature instead of against her to grow the best pecans money can buy. That's the way we say it.
Swift's pecan orchard covers more than 250 acres. Lots of insects affect pecans, like moths and stink bugs, which bats love to munch. But when Swift first bought his orchard in 1998, he protected his trees the way everyone did, with plenty of chemicals.
Fungicide, insecticide, herbicide.
That started to change, though, after Swift met Merlin Tuttle in the mid-2000s. Swift first knew Tuttle as the guy he let fish on his property.
But then I found out he was a famous bat scientist.
Tuttle spent 65 years studying bats around the globe, including at Swift's orchard. Tuttle says you'd be hard-pressed to find better bat habitat.
If your orchard is near a river, you have a very good opportunity for attracting bats to bat houses.
Tuttle's been using the orchard to experiment with bat boxes, tweaking the color and position, even the kind of wood they're made with. Swift also runs a sawmill at his orchard where he makes lumber out of cypress trees. Turns out it's perfect for bat houses.
It's extra lightweight, extra insulative, and yet it's one of the longest lasting woods in America.
This punky cypress, as it's called, is porous on the inside, which gives the bats something to hold on to in the house. It also regulates temperature well, which is crucial for bats in hot places.
What we're doing is actually helping. We're not just giving the bats that are already there a place to live. We're building populations with more bats than there were previously.
There are dozens of bat boxes now on Swift's property, housing hundreds of bats. So many, in fact, Swift decided to just let them handle the bugs on part of his property this year.
This year is the first year I did not spray any insecticide at all. And guess what? We got a really good crop over there.
Reducing reliance on insecticides is one of Swift's big goals because of how they can harm ecosystems, human health, and a farmer's bottom line. Not every farm can do this, though. Russ Benedict is a biology professor at Central College in Iowa who studies bats in agriculture.
Primarily, I hear those in, you know, smaller operations, folks who are doing organic farming, that kind of stuff. Among the corn and soybean folks, I haven't really heard that much.
Bats need diversity in their diet, and they can't get it from a landscape that's just acres and acres of the same crop, according to Benedict. They don't thrive in wide open areas either, but for those farms where bats could make a difference, Troy Swift is ready to share what he's learned on his pecan farm.
I really want to have an impact on agriculture. This is not just pecans. Bats eat stink bugs and corn earworms. So that's good for all agriculture. And when you talk about mosquitoes and flies, it's also good for people. Yeah. I mean, have you been bit by a mosquito since you've been here?
I had not. Neither had he. And for that, we could thank the bats. I'm Michael Marks, Harvest Public Media.
Missouri has joined over 30 states in banning or limiting the use of cell phones in schools starting this fall. St. Louis Public Radio teamed up with student journalists at one school who interviewed some of their peers about the transition. Hiba Ahmed reports.
The sound of students chatting during downtime has returned to the classrooms at Rockwood Summit High School in Fenton. It's something science teacher Sean Tagorley says he's missed. He's been teaching at Rockwood Summit for a decade.
In years prior, I'd give them free time and it was dead silent. For like my perspective, whenever I give them a little bit of free time, it's so much louder now because they are like conversing and talking and getting together and they're like moving tables and then even a little bit of horseplay. But honestly, like I kind of love it.
Missouri passed a law this summer that requires all public schools, including charter schools, to restrict cell phones, smartwatches, wireless headphones, and other personal devices from the start to the end of the school day. Students are allowed to store their phones in their backpacks and grab them in emergencies. There are also exceptions for students who use their phones for medical purposes or to support them in their individual education plans or IEPs. The policy went into effect at the start of the school year, but some school districts, like Rockwood, began piloting a less restrictive cell phone ban last year, according to Superintendent Curtis Kane. Students were allowed to be on their phones during lunch and passing periods, but not during instructional time.
In our student handbook, it clearly states that a building principal and teachers within their classroom have always had the right to say, we're not going to do cell phones here. Always had that right. So it may feel large and very amplified, but there have been pieces along the way, especially for us in the Rockwood School District. We've been marching towards something that's looked different with cell phones for some time.
A recent study from the Pew Research Center found that over 70% of U.S. adults support a cell phone ban for middle and high schoolers. But how do students feel about the policy? St. Louis Public Radio partnered with student journalists Amanda Mertens and Emery Gregston, both juniors at Rockwood Summit, who interviewed 10 of their peers.
I really do not like the new policy.
Face-to-face conversations have improved with this new policy.
Yeah, I think everyone is a little bit more focused in class.
That was senior Mariah Hybor and juniors Anish Sadala and Brody Husted. Students were asked if they had noticed an impact on their mental health, a reason that's often cited to support cell phone bans. Here's senior Sarah Howe.
It's the same thing. After school, I can still surf the internet and go on social media. And obviously social media definitely takes a toll on mental health, especially as a teenage girl. So I think it's the same effect on my mental health, whether I'm surfing the internet in school or out of school.
Research is still in the early stages, so it's too soon to tell how cell phone bans may impact the mental health of minors. But last year, U.S. Surgeon General Vivek Murthy released an advisory calling for more attention to the impact of social media on youth mental health. Rockwood Summit principal Emily McCown says that most students are following the new rules, but she started to see a couple of referrals trickle into her office as the school year carries on. She attributes the success to three things: last year's partial cell phone ban, regular reminders from teachers at the start of the day, and,
you know, if a kid is complaining about it, it's like, well, I mean, it's a law now, you know, right? So they have kind of that in their back pocket.
McCown says she's interested to see how students continue to adapt to the restrictions throughout the school year. She's already noticed an age-old tradition make a reappearance.
I did find a really good note in the hall the other day. So somebody was writing some notes going back really old school.
And on that note, I'm Hiba Ahmed, St. Louis Public Radio.
With the cold weather hitting the region, Illinoisans have been using more natural gas to heat their homes. In the last 6 years, Ameren's been working to renovate its natural gas storage fields to make them more efficient for the company, and they say save customers money. Will Bauer recently toured one of those fields in southern Illinois, near Freeburg, and he has this report.
Before sub-freezing temperatures prompted Metro's residents to turn on their heat, Ameren employees had nearly topped off their massive container of natural gas.
Okay, this is the facility that we use to both push the gas in the ground and withdraw it in the wintertime.
That's Tim Eggers. He's Ameren's director of gas storage in Illinois. He's walking through the storage field near Freeburg.
There's an 18-inch diameter transmission pipeline that takes the natural gas into the load area, which is, you know, the Metro East service territory. So we're covering every town from Belleville all the way up to Collinsville, Edwardsville.
The storage site in St. Clair County is one of 12 Ameren has for Illinois service. The utility company buys natural gas from places like Oklahoma, Kansas, Texas, Pennsylvania, and even Canada. While the company is well-connected via a massive pipeline network, Ameren doesn't have complete control over natural gas prices.
And pretty much if you're seeing those zero-degree temperatures, you're seeing the gas market very, very high. And that's when our value really, you know, shows itself.
And that's why the company has invested in their storage fields. At this one near Freeburg, Ameren can store 1.9 billion cubic feet of gas. From April to October, they will buy gas when it's cheap and save it for winter. Before this year's winter weather, Ameren purchased gas at $3 per million British thermal units, or MBTUs. During this past January's nasty cold spell, prices reached $20. During wintertime, Ameren will supply gas to homes all over downstate Illinois. That's 60% from the storage fields and 40% that's coming directly from the pipeline network, generally at a higher price. Brad Kleppel is Ameren's Senior Director of Gas Services.
The business case is just so solid for these. I mean, they not only are we improving the health of the facility, which improves the reliability for our customers, we're actually lowering our operating costs by doing this.
The storage fields require a very specific set of geological factors, mainly sandstone. Basically, Ameren pumps natural gas down hundreds of feet into the rock. Because sandstone is so porous, it can absorb and store natural gas. In 2019, Ameren started experimenting with a way to make this technology more efficient. It's called horizontal drilling. Again, here's Kleppel.
Instead of just drilling straight down into it vertically, where you just have access to that area around that wellhead, you actually drill down into that zone, and then you angle the drill bit, and then you go horizontal right through the center of that for like another 1,000 or 2,000 feet.
The idea here is that Ameren can take up a lot less space on the surface. Near Freeburg, they went from 81 to 18 wells and 4,600 acres to 10. The final phase of this change was one part of Ameren's rate request to the Illinois Commerce Commission this year. Late last month, the state regulators cut Ameren's request from nearly $130 million to around $70. Abe Scar, who directs the Illinois Public Interest Research Group, says these modernization efforts may help. However, he says they may be limited in their ability to control prices.
If gas prices rise significantly overall, there's no amount of arbitrage that you can do that's going to, you know, completely shield people from the ups and downs of gas prices, which tend to be highly volatile.
Illinois has also committed to transition away from greenhouse gases. Scar says the utility company could lead the way in the transition toward heating homes with electricity.
Some level of investment is necessary, and we need to keep the gas system safe while we're using it. But we should really be reducing our investment in it, not increasing it.
With the Commerce Commission's decision, Ameren still anticipates completing the conversion near Freeburg on time next year. But the same efforts at the storage field further away near Centralia could be delayed. In Freeburg, I'm Will Bauer.
A We'll hear from the former U.S. Ambassador and U.S. Senator, Carol Mosley Braun. That's ahead on Statewide. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. In her new memoir, Trailblazer, Carol Mosley Braun shares the highs and high costs of breaking barriers. She was the first Black woman elected to the U.S. Senate, and she writes about her experiences. She later went on to become a U.S. ambassador. She spoke with NPR's Michelle Martin about her political origin story in Illinois and the expectations she faced while in office.
Ambassador, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, I'm so delighted to be with you. Good to talk with you again.
And it's Ambassador Mosley Braun because in addition to having been a U.S. Senator and a number of other offices in politics, you were also U.S. Ambassador to New Zealand and Samoa. So you've been out of public life for a while. What made you want to tell your story now? Was there any particular thing pushing you?
You know, my little grandbaby, he's 7 now. He came and said, Grandma Carol, are you famous? And I tried to explain it to him, but, you know, it's too many words. And he was only 6 at the time. So I said, you know what? I think that now is the time.
Why did you decide to get into elected office to begin with? Will you tell that story?
I've been assistant United States attorney, and I had my son. And so I was here with him. I was just doing it, being a homemaker, which was fine. I really enjoyed it. But there were people in the neighborhood who were protesting the removal of the bobolinks from Jackson Park. And I joined them one day, and the bobolinks are these little rice birds, originally from South Carolina, but somehow or another they wound up here in Chicago, okay? And so some of the people with whom I was marching said, we think you should run for state representative. Our state representative is retiring. So at first I demurred and wouldn't do it. But then after I got challenged, there's a pundit here in Chicago who said, don't run, you can't possibly win. The Blacks won't vote for you because you're not part of the Chicago machine. The whites won't vote for you because you're Black. And nobody's going to vote for you because you're a woman. And so that was my inspiration. That's what did it.
And nobody thought you could win, except you.
Nobody thought I could win. She lost all of her mind. Yeah.
But one of the things that was also interesting in the book is that so many of the jobs that you had, there was a point at which nobody believed it was you actually had that job. I mean, you tell the story right. About like being an assistant U.S. attorney and coming home from one of those cold Chicago winters, trying to get home, and you're trying to hail a taxi. This is pre-Uber, of course.
Yep.
And this police officer keeps riding by you saying, what was he saying? Get off that corner.
Give up that corner. Give up that corner. Yep.
Give up that corner. And he thought you were
a hooker.
Because what? Why else would a Black woman dressed up?
Because I was a Black woman standing on the corner in downtown Chicago.
And then you talked about your first day at the Senate when you tried to get to your office. There was a Capitol Police officer who...
Wouldn't let me in.
Wouldn't let exactly. You in.
Well, the guy, you know, there are always 2 Capitol Police standing on the doors to the Senate. The first guy, he said, you can't go in there. I said, I looked at him like quizzically, like, why can't I? Then the other guy piped in and said, oh, she's the new senator from Illinois. And so that backed his colleague off.
I don't want people to think that the entire memoir is just filled with like these insults directed at you, although there were many, like, for example, the senator who would sing Dixie in your presence and so forth.
Right.
And so there's that. But there were some structural issues that you also pointed out that made your job more difficult than for other people, like, for example, the amount of mail that you got. Could you talk about that?
The mail was really a challenge because there was so much of it. I mean, they gave me a room in the basement of the Capitol that was filled with these duffel bags full of mail. There was no way I could possibly do all of that by myself. And so I went to leadership and I asked for assignment of some help. And one guy said to me, well, Ted Kennedy gets a lot of mail and, you know, he handles it. I'm thinking, you're telling me I got to function like Ted Kennedy does? I was too outdone.
But they never gave you additional staff just to deal with
the
mail.
No, they did not.
And do you think that played some role over the course of your tenure, the kind of angst that sometimes built up around you, that people felt that you weren't doing the job?
It might have. But, again, you can't make everybody happy. But if you do the job, then people can't take pot shots at you.
Well, they did, though.
Yeah, they did.
Why do you think you served only one term?
because of that. You know, there was such expectations and people expected me to come to every chicken fry in the state and I couldn't do it. You know, I did as much as I could, but I couldn't do all of it.
Do you think that's why? I mean, you think that at the end of the day, the expectations of you were just greater than you could as one person fulfill?
That's part of it. But I think it's also what standard you're being held to. Again, I was kind of the duckbill platypus of the Senate in the sense that I was not only a woman, but I was Black, too. And I am Black, too. And so you put those things together and what you have is a set of expectations that border on the unreasonable, that border on the trailblazing, groundbreaking, if you will. And so I did my very best to live up to those expectations, but it was not always possible.
Is there anything you wish you'd done differently?
Well, not really. I you know, I did the best job I could while I was planted. I really did. And I still am. I mean, I'm not dead yet. It's like, I spoke at a high school, at a grammar school rather, and the school was named after me. And one little boy said, "Hey, there goes Carol Moseley Braun." And his little friend turned around and said, "You mean she's not dead yet?" No, she's not dead yet. So I'm still here. So while I'm still here and able to tell the story, that's why the book made sense to do.
Well, one of the things about being first is it often makes things easier for people who are next, right?
Follow.
The second,
yes.
And the third and the fourth. Is there something in particular that you think made it easier for them by the fact that you went first?
Well, I hope the fact that I deflected all of the brickbats, that I don't think anybody's going to be held to the same kind of standard I was being held to in terms of, you know, production. I hope that that has really provided a roadmap to people who come afterwards. Don't get distracted with all the noise around you, because there will be lots of noise around you. But if you don't let that distract you and you just keep focusing on what the people elected you to do, you'll be fine.
That is Ambassador Carol Moseley Braun. She's the author of Trailblazer, Perseverance in Life and Politics. Ambassador Moseley Braun, thank you so much for talking with us.
I'm so happy to talk to you again, Michelle.
You may want to keep that hand sanitizer, a mask, and vitamin C on your list of essentials this winter. Flu season is expected to be worse than usual. Mariah Wolfel has more.
The flu vaccine is less effective this year because it was developed to protect against strains that have actually already morphed and changed. But the University of Chicago's Dr. Emily Landon says there are ways to stay healthy this winter.
Stay away from people that are coughing at the grocery store. Wash your hands after you do all that shopping because there are people there who are still shopping even though they're not feeling good. You know, masks and hand sanitizer are your friend.
Landon says getting enough sleep and eating healthy are also crucial to boosting your immunity, which will help fight the flu if you do get it. And she says even though the flu vaccine is less effective this year, she says some protection is better than none.
Mariah Wolfel with that report. Early this year, a small college in northern Wisconsin abruptly shut down, leaving students scrambling. One of the many losses was the school's hockey program. That was until another Wisconsin college stepped up to give the program a new home. Peter Medlin reports.
Playing this game is a privilege. Don't take it for granted. Shane Buckley's preached it to his players countless times coaching college hockey. He heard it himself back when he played. You never know when you'll lace your skates for the last time.
February of 2025, got an email on a Wednesday basically saying, hey, the school is closing down. So that weekend was actually playoffs for hockey. So we weren't even done with our season yet.
Buckley was the head men's hockey coach at Division III Northland College, a tiny school steps from Lake Superior, which was also his alma mater. The news was shocking. It was a lot to process, but Buckley's first thought was about the team.
These 27 guys, where are they going to go next year?
He quickly called the team together. They heard the news the same time he did. And even though they were in the middle of playoff prep, he gave them a choice. Do you want to go home or do you want to get out on the ice?
Hockey is like our getaway. All the problems go away once you hit the ice. And I think that's what everyone wanted to do was just kind of forget about it and just do the thing that we love the most.
That's defenseman Sam Holey. The Northland women's team was also preparing for a playoff game. Forward Kennedy Grucke says the closure was hard to believe, but they knew the college was struggling. Northland nearly closed the previous year and raised over $1 million to keep the doors open. But Grucke says they were promised they'd have more time.
All the incoming freshmen from last year assumed that they'd be able to graduate the year after. Recruits that came in were told that they'd be able to graduate as well.
That week was a whirlwind. Grookey's teammate Rachel Fusi says it brought the community together, but putting on her Northland jersey for the last time was really hard, especially knowing it would be the last time anyone put on that jersey.
We're leaving all our best friends behind, and it was very emotional. And for me, it was almost hard to focus on the game because I was so caught up in what's going to happen after this.
On the same day he learned the college was closing, Shane Buckley got an email from Beloit College. And they didn't have a hockey program, but they were interested in starting one by bringing in Northland's players and coaches. Buckley told his seniors, like Holy, but didn't want to get the team's hopes up too much in case the opportunity fell through.
Last year, you know, I was the only captain on the team, and he kind of put that trust in me. So to show him that I have trust in him, I was just like, hey, wherever you end up going, like, that's where I want to be.
Quickly after, Buckley and other coaches took a trip from Ashland on Wisconsin's northern tip down to the southern border to visit Beloit. Karen Shadeen is Beloit's VP for Enrollment, Marketing, and Athletics. She's the one who reached out to Buckley that first day. And as the college tries to increase enrollments and athletic offerings, here in Wisconsin, she says ice hockey seemed like a no-brainer.
It's sad to see another institution close. So really, our thought process was all about getting students a new home. Where could they go?
And it was a good fit. 37 students transferred from Northland to Beloit, only a few of whom were not on the hockey teams. It's a lot, especially considering Northland's enrollment had fallen to just about 250 near the end. Shadeen says they tried to make enrollment as easy as possible so players weren't scared of credits not transferring.
We took the approach that we were just onboarding them as Beloit students as opposed to putting someone through an admissions process.
That took a lot of stress off of senior defenseman Trey Taylor. He's one of the Canadians on the team, and the visa process makes everything complex, and he wasn't sure if he could afford to pay for an extra year of school if credits didn't move properly.
Especially with the exchange rate, too, it's not really too kind right now, so trying to find possibly a school that fits my budget. So that was kind of the real hard part about it, is there's a lot of panic kind of setting in.
Holy says it's been a smooth transition for the team, athletically, socially, and academically. In fact, he says with Northland's enrollment falling these past few years, it really limited some academic opportunities.
Our last year, most of our business classes, if not all of them, were online. So we were basically teaching ourselves because they were in the transition of getting new business professors. But unfortunately, they couldn't hire any to move up there and live up there.
He says Beloit's athletic facilities are newer and they have more training resources. They're also playing at the brand new Woodman Center in Janesville, which Holy says will hopefully help with recruitment. That was difficult the last few years at Northland with the school on the brink of closure. Last year, the women's team couldn't skate with a full team. Now, both squads have a full roster, including other transfers and new freshmen. About two-thirds of the men's and a little less than half of the women's team are from Northland. And Buckley says that Beloit feels like home now, and getting back onto the ice has been a relief after the stress and uncertainty of these past few months.
It's led to a really good dynamic in our locker room right now, where it's not much is taken for granted, because they know how, you know, based on our situation just a few months ago, things can change pretty quickly. So
the women's team recently played its first game, and forward Rachel Fusi says she could really feel the energy.
Our last game was really emotional, but this game is like, it's kind of like almost like a deep breath moment, like, oh, we made it, we're here, like this is happening, like we're having a season together, and it's something really special.
And crowds packed into the Woodman Center for the men's home opener. The puck drops for the first ever Beloit Buccaneers hockey season. But just because they're building something new doesn't mean they have to forget about their Northland roots. The former Northlanders have stickers on their helmet to commemorate their old school, and Buckley says even the jerseys retired at Northland are honored in Beloit.
Being an alumni, like Northland and Northland hockey was always, you know, very special to me. So to be able to go back and be the last coach at Northland, to be able to keep those Northland traditions alive here, it has meant a lot for sure.
The Bucks fall behind 1-0, but in the second period, Beloit hits the equalizer. It's a hard-fought game. They trade power plays, the sides shove each other into the boards. Beloit ends up losing this one 4-2. But these teams have faced plenty of adversity before. They know this game's a privilege. They'll pick themselves off the ice and move forward. and they hope their brand of resilience will set the standard for the future of Beloit hockey. I'm Peter Mudlin.
We're out of time for Statewide. Thanks for joining us. And don't forget to be with us next week. We'll be back with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. Find us where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.